It's my doom, I think, to go to that shadow yonder, so that a way will be found. But will good or evil show it to me? What hope we had was in speed. Delay plays into the enemy's hands, and here I am delayed. Is it the will of the dark tower that steers us? All my choices have proved ill. The passage of the marshes. It is episode 58 of the Grey Company Podcast. We're back again to press on with the book club into new territory with book 4. Tonight we'll explore The Taming of Smeagol, The Passage of the Marshes, and The Black Gate is Closed. Joining me tonight is... Dan.
I think when we get to the end of this whole story and we're doing Taming of the,
The appendices? That's not...
Yeah, I was going to say, I was thinking Taming of Smeagol and then the whole Shire thing, and it just totally conflated the two in my mind. But anyway, I think we should have one where we just drink the entire time and just see how ridiculous it gets.
Oh, no, that'd be great.
I am doing well. There is one little bit of self-promotion I'm going to do because it might actually help people follow along in the book club. I added one feature to the ye olde search engine. Cue Matthew's voice saying, "What search engine?"
There it is.
And if you go to the scenarios page, there's now an option to view a map view. And I have to give a huge shout out to Ecthelion, because he actually was the one that made this image. But the really cool thing that I did with a little bit of bare programming skills is that if you mouse over any one of the icons, it actually gives you a path for everything that's in that particular quest or set of quests. So if you mouse over... like the Shadow of the Pass, which is the first of the Fellowship scenarios, it'll give you lines through all across the map through all the different spots. So it's really helpful as we get into these areas like the Dead Marshes that I always forget exactly where they are in relationship to everything else and where the, you know, different mountains are and Minas Morgul versus, you know, Aura Druin and all the other stuff. It's nice to have a map to look at. So that's
my one perfect. Little... I just pulled it up. Man, this is great. So who did you say helped you with this?
Ecthelion from the Discord. Shout out to him for making the image, and then the bear did the programming. But it's definitely can help people along as far as the geography as we're going through the story.
That's great.
Anyway, how are you doing, Ian?
I am not bad. I am just doing all the usual stuff, and glad to be back for this big book club. For the beginning of kind of a new section of the books. I guess I have my own bit of self-promotion, which is the next First Stage quest should be coming out soon, probably before our next book club recording, so within the next 2 weeks.
That's awesome.
So this is the Fall of Nargothrond, the fourth quest in my kind of Turin-Turimbar cycle, so this one is going to be the first appearance of Glaurung, the dragon, and not the internet personality.
Is he still around?
Which one?
well, nice.
That's funny. That's solid.
But yeah, it should be a fun one, not to pat myself on the back too hard.
Is that the story where he shows up too late and then Glaurung is there and like hypnotizes him?
Yeah, it's kind of the big battle where Glaurung is sent to basically topple the kingdom of Nargothrond, and Turin is full of pride as usual, goes off and fight in the battle. Then he goes back to try to, kind of save people, but at this point Glaurung has hypnotized everyone and hypnotizes Turin as well, so yeah. There'll definitely be some hypnotizing action in the quest as well.
Hypnotize keywords.
Yep. Awesome.
That's good.
It should just have like little swirls on the card that spin around like the Hypnotoad in Futurama.
All hail Hypnoglaron. That's awesome.
That's good. Well, I am keeping my pulse to the Fantasy Flight Interactive. I don't know where I was going with that metaphor, but I'm keeping my eye on Fantasy Flight Interactive because I have high hopes for the digital version of the game. I really hope it's good just so I have a way to play more frequently. But I was kind of sad to see that they delayed the release of Early Access, but we'll keep an eye on it. It's going to be, it's obviously going to be a a little more simplified than the tabletop, but I'm anxious to get my hands on it to see if it's any good.
Yeah, I look forward to playing it. Speaking of digital games, one thing people might want to look out for, in case they didn't know and haven't checked Octagon in a while, is Octagon actually, well, the LOTR portion of Octagon actually has a save feature. It only took however many years, but you can actually save your games in Octagon now, which is a big help.
That's cool.
7 years later. Yeah. Look at that.
And it, well, and it wasn't even the Octagon folks who did it. It was someone along the way took it upon themselves to make one for Arkham, and then C-Stan and a few other people, I think. I'm not sure who else helped out with adapting it for Lord of the Rings. Anyway, it's there, so use it.
That's cool.
Great work, guys.
Well done.
Great work.
So we're not here to talk about games, though. We're here to talk about books. So Matthew is, of course, with us in spirit as we continue on with our book club tonight. And the same way we do every book club, we are going to go chapter by chapter. We're going to give a quick recap of the story, and then we're going to discuss said story, and then we're going to talk about the cards in the game and the scenarios in the game that have helped to bring this chapter to life, and generally what we think of those. So let's see. Are we ready to tame some Smeagols?
Mm-hmm. Got my hot pants on.
Yes, we are.
Let's do it. So the first chapter of Book 4 is, of course, the Taming of Smeagol. We are finally back to seeing what became of Sam and Frodo. Remember, we haven't seen them since the end of Fellowship of the Ring, at the breaking of the Fellowship, when they were paddling across the falls of Rauros. And so we return to Sam and Frodo, who are lost in the Emyn Muil. They scuttle uphill and down, looking for a way out of the stony ridges, managing to climb down using Sam's real elvish rope. They are then set upon by Gollum, but they are ready for him. They bind the poor creature, and then, realizing they need his help as a guide, Frodo allows him to swear by the ring to lead them well and not to turn on them. Hence the Taming of Smeagol. So, the first dominant feature of this chapter is the land itself, the hills of the Emyn Muil, which, of course, is a reference to the quest in the first cycle of this game. And Sam and Frodo are basically trapped by not only the rocky, stony ridges themselves, but the weather as well. And so I think this kind of chapter could be a little slow, could be a little boring. Like, the people who like to criticize The Lord of the Rings say it's just people walking and then they drop the ring in the volcano. And this is perhaps one of... Actually, each of these chapters could kind of be described in that way. But, I don't know, I think it's pretty cool that the land itself gets to kind of take center stage, at least at the beginning of the chapter. I don't know, do you guys have anything to say about that in terms of, you know, the the chapter holding your interest or not holding your interest?
Yeah, I think I'm on the team of the people that say that this is a boring part of the book. These are not my favorite chapters.
Mm-hmm.
There are some good things, but for me, I can see how enough description of the rocks and later on the marshes, I just kind of go, okay, that's great, let's move on.
I've seen a swamp before.
I guess I'm on the team that I enjoy these chapters. I'm not, and it's hard for me to put the finger exactly on why, other than just generally enjoying Tolkien's language use and kind of being a super fanboy in that realm, which, and kind of the way he evokes the different moods of the different landscapes they go through. Maybe not as much in the Emyn Muil portion, but more so in the Den Marshes and the portion that follows after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, his language, that was one of the things I did notice in reading these three chapters in a go, which is a lot of Tolkien to absorb in one sitting, but his language gets more poetic as it gets along, because I think that's one of the reasons why I don't like Emyn Muil as much, is he's a little bit more just kind of clinically descriptive, and then obviously when he gets into like the candle corpses and all the other stuff with the Dead Marshes, you get like callbacks to history, and then you get kind of a little bit more poetry in his use of language, and that's definitely more enjoyable to me than the early stuff. But yeah, the Emyn Muil stuff is about as boring as the quest was in
my that quest,
which is it makes sense why that quest is boring now, because you're basically just adapting.
It made me appreciate whoever designed it. It was actually a thematic win. Like, I was falling asleep reading about Emyn Muil in the book, and I was falling asleep, you know, just trying to clear the damn locations in the quest. So it worked out.
Yeah. If only when that quest came out, we would have had Fast Hitch. Did we have Fast Hitch at that quest by then?
I think so. I think that was... Wait.
Same cycle anyway.
Yeah, was that Dead Marshes that it came out in? So it would have been after?
Yeah.
I think it might have been.
Right. Yeah, yeah. You're right. It came out after Immon Wheel.
So there you go. We didn't have the Fast Hitch to get us out of the Immon Wheel. But this is kind of, you know, I'm jumping ahead a little bit to the card descriptions. But this is where we see both... Sam's rope, which he got from the Elves of Lothlorien, but also his Fast Hitch, his the magical knot that he learned from the Gaffer.
Yeah, I think there's a few notable things, and like part of the thing I love about doing the book club is because it makes me read the chapters in a different way. Because usually, maybe I wouldn't get as much enjoyment from the chapters because I'm just breezing through. But here, I'm trying to really like dig into everything. Like, what does this mean? So I was just thinking about. It's funny because this is the first we see of Sam and Frodo's journey on their own post leaving, and it starts with them basically figuring out how to climb down a cliff. Like, that's how it starts. And so then that gets me thinking the same old question as always, like, why did Tolkien do that? And I'm sure that, you know, Tolkien was a mere mortal, so there are times when he just did things as an author, I'm sure, but there are other times where I think stuff can be intentional. And in this case, I feel like it's kind of one of those things where you have these two very small heroes now on their own, and they're starting off with kind of the most mundane challenge possible, which is just against these elements and figuring how to get down a hill, basically.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, they've been surrounded by this. They've been a small part of a fellowship with very powerful, knowledgeable members, and now they really are completely isolated, and they're in, you know, even though Frodo had studied maps a lot, you know, they get to a point, and it describes it later on, I think even in this Taming of Smeagol chapter, where there's a point where they just have no idea where they are.
Yeah, exactly. But one thing that does keep the chapter alive when it should, you know, by all accounts be boring, is the Hobbit banter, which never ceases to amuse me. So kind of going back to the Fast Hitch, it talks about how Sam says, "I may not be much good at climbing, Mr. Frodo," he said in an injured tone, "but I do know something about rope and about knots. It's in the family, as you might say." Then he goes on about his granddad and his Uncle Andy and stuff like that. So all that stuff that he's like so offended that Frodo thought that his knot just didn't hold up is enough to kind of crack me up, even though they're in this miserable part of Middle Earth.
Yeah, one thing I'm really grateful for from the movies is actually now whenever I read the Gollum passages, especially the Gollum passages directed at Sam, I read it in Andy Serkis's voice.
Yeah,
so it's just like, oh, the fat boys won't shut up about ropes already. Like, it makes it really funny.
Yeah, it's funny. I find that I bounce back and forth between Andy Serkis and then there's a recording of Tolkien reading Riddles in the Dark where he does Smeagol's Gollum's voice. So I find I'm evenly split between the two voices as I narrated this thing in my head.
We need to link that in the show notes if we can, because I would love.
Yeah, I'm
to
sure
hear
it's
that.
On YouTube. I'll try to find it right now, actually.
But, yeah.
So one of the speaking of which, go ahead.
I was just gonna say one of the things that I was kind of keeping an eye on is through all these chapters, because it was conversation I had in Discord recently, but I've had a million times before, was this idea of like, how much of a hero was Frodo compared to Sam? Because I feel like nowadays Sam gets the lion's share of the credit, which, you know, he deserves to a large extent. But I've seen people go so far as to say that Frodo is just kind of a passenger in the journey. And it was pretty much Sam and Gollum's show, and Frodo wasn't really doing much. So I was keeping a special eye this time around to see whether that was true or not. And so in this first chapter, I was struck by that Frodo was very much in the leadership role, at least at this point, to the point of like Sam is like, okay, let's try this cliff, and just goes jumping down without even checking first how to get down. And Frodo's like, what are you doing, you idiot? Get back up here. So I feel like Frodo is very much kind of setting the pace right now and you know, warning Sam about how to get down this cliff. And also he's the one who's really demanding that they move forward fast. Like, Sam wants to take their time and not go down in the dark. Because, you know, that is kind of the common sense thing. Don't go down in the dark. But Frodo has this sixth sense, for lack of a better phrase, that he needs to go as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I think I wrote a whole Master of Lore article about how I think Frodo kind of gets a bad rap, and one of the things that helped me appreciate Frodo is and his kind of gentle, erudite nature. It is a part in this chapter, so I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. We're going to the end of the chapter where Frodo is taming Smeagol, and I'll read a little bit. It says, "For a moment it appeared to Sam that his master had grown and Gollum had shrunk, a tall, stern shadow, a mighty lord who hid his brightness in the gray cloud, and at his feet a little whining dog. If the two were in some way akin and not alien, they could reach one another's minds." So, you know, that's not just Frodo as he appears to Smeagol as a ring bearer, but that's kind of Frodo at his core, where he does have this lordly, elvish nature about him, even for a hobbit. And so when you talk about Frodo taking the leadership role, that's the image that comes to mind, is that, you know, he's often very gentle and quiet about it, and that comes up more when we get to the third chapter of this book. But even that little description, I think, is a great insight into who Frodo is, not just as a ring bearer, but as a character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great quote that you gave. And there's nuance here that I don't want to just trot all over. I feel like people that say, oh, Sam's clearly the hero and Frodo didn't really do anything, I don't think they really understand the dynamic, because honestly, if Sam had been the one driving things from the beginning, they would have been dead in their sleep. Quite frankly, like one of the reasons they're still alive is that Frodo has an insight into Gollum, mm-hmm. because they have the shared experience of being a ring bearer. And that insight is critical, and their fates are from here to the end of the book, the fates of Sam and Frodo and Gollum are intertwined. And so the fact that Frodo has that insight, and like you said, has like that kind of elvish nature, is super important here, because Sam is described almost like a dog at one point in one of these chapters, and it's very appropriate that, like, he's really excited and he just wants to, like, oh, we're going to go off the cliff. Okay, let me go over the cliff. And he's just, like, ready to go. But he isn't necessarily thinking before he acts. And it's important that Frodo's there as the one that kind of has insight into what Gollum's thinking, and has this kind of broader sense of what their task is that's ahead of them. And without that, Sam's loyalty is awesome, but he's kind of like the action without thinking side of it. Yeah. So he needs to be counterbalanced by Frodo, is my take on it.
Yeah, he kind of Frodo makes the most momentous decision of all, which we're kind of referring to, which is to not only spare Gollum, but take him along as a guide, which is, like you said, Dan, without that choice, like, they're dead, basically, as we'll see in the next couple chapters. One of the interesting things that happens is when he's making this decision, he actually has a full flashback where Tolkien takes that chunk of conversation he had with Gandalf about why did Bilbo spare Gollum, and just plops it in the text here is kind of Frodo flashing back, and Sam kind of sees him having that flashback. But the reason that's interesting to me is I can't think of any other time in The Lord of the Rings where that happens, so it feels like it's especially significant that Tolkien chose to do that.
Yeah, usually he's giving you the foreshadowing, or he's giving you the looking backward much more obliquely, but you're absolutely right. I have that whole section underlined because it's obviously really critical that there be this deeper understanding in Frodo's mind of, like, hey, and there's even a sympathy there that I really like, where he and Sam detest Gollum on some level, especially when Gollum talks about some of the stuff and
Sauron.
His eating habits, and even just his the way he talks familiarity about Sauron is, like, really kind of creepy. There's a part also where Frodo has real sympathy, because he knows what it's like to have the ring and that burden, and that burden's only going to become greater as time goes on. And I think he starts to really understand, like, hey, this poor creature had this thing for years, and of course it changed him.
Right.
So one of the things we see is kind of this inner conflict between, I guess, for lack of a better word, the Gollum and Smeagol sides, the Slinker and Stinker sides, as Sam called them. But I guess what I'm wondering, what do you guys, your guys' take on this is, what do you think was the biggest factor in kind of precipitating Gollum to maybe surface that Smeagol side a little more? Like, was it just the threat? Because Frodo has this kind of metal moment of threatening to put on the ring and command Gollum to throw himself into the fire, which is a bit of a foreshadowing of later. Was it just that fear of God or fear of Frodo in the ring? Or was it the fact that someone actually showed him mercy for maybe the first time in his life? Like, what was it that actually inspired some degree of... It's not quite loyalty, because obviously he's willing to betray him later, but a little bit of softness towards Frodo, I guess.
What's your take on that, Derek?
I think that it has to do with a couple different things. One, I think, as you said, Frodo shows some kindness, but also I wonder if Gollum feels secure having a master. Because remember, the only thing that matters to Gollum is the ring. And so in a sense, with Frodo revealing himself a little bit in his power as a ring bearer, it's almost like the master of the ring is also his master. So I wonder if he found a sense of security in that, which allowed him to relax and not feel, I don't know, as grovelly as he does all the time. Because I'm looking at the paragraph right now, which is immediately after he makes his promise, and it talks about how he, you know, he would cackle and laugh and caper if any jest was made. He would weep, but he would also weep if Frodo rebuked him. So I don't know. It's like there's this sense of freedom there, and maybe he's free because he's secure in having a master, so to speak, and he's not so consumed with the ring for some reason. I don't know. I'm not totally sure.
Yeah, I definitely feel like there's multiple things going on. Like I want my answer to Ian's question to be like both in a way, because I feel like obviously the ring has power over him. I mean, when Gollum is the one, if I remember right, that is offers to swear on the ring, and Frodo's the one that says, well, are you sure you want to do that? Do you understand, you know, the magnitude of what you're doing? But so the ring having power is clearly part of it, but I also feel like there is this hint at, like, maybe there's the potential for redemption for for Gollum. Like, that definitely, I think it might be a little bit later that they get into that with the marshes, but and it is kind of an ebb and flow based on whether or not Black Riders have showed up, and based on as they get closer to where the ring was made, and there's all these things that are starting to like weigh on all of them as they move on, and the countenance of things change, especially after one of the Black Riders goes by. It really puts, there's a fear in Gollum from having encountered Sauron and his servants in the past, that they can't ever really overcome in all these chapters. But I feel like there is a sense of him in like community where there is almost a potential for redemption, and just being around Frodo and having Frodo be nice to him is such a refreshing thing. Cause it actually makes it really sad. Cause when you think back on the last, like, you know, 10 years or however long of basically ever since he lost the ring, Gollum has lived a really sad life, right? Like, the one thing that he cared about in all, you know, his tiny reality living in that cave in the Misty Mountains is gone. And then he spends all this time trying to find it. And he gets captured by Sauron and captured by the elves and captured by Aragorn. And basically everyone's just kind of trying to control him and torture him and get information out of him. And that's a really sad existence. So yeah. Having someone be nice to him, it makes sense that he would kind of change, do a 180.
Yeah. I guess one other thing that's worth touching on before we talk about cards along these lines is the nature of oaths in Middle-earth. Now, Ian, you've been cracking away at your first age, your amazing first age expansion for a while now, so you're well aware of the role that oaths have in the first age. But we see this here, too, the most glaring example, of course, being the Oathbreakers who appear in the Return of the King. But I wonder also if kind of what we're saying has something to do with the power of your words and the power of, you know, what you say you're going to do in Middle Earth. Because, you know, Dan, you mentioned how Frodo says, like, don't swear on the ring because it will hold you to it. You know, it's gonna get you, in effect. So I just wonder if there's kind of like another wrinkle there as we think about what oaths mean in kind of this cosmic sense in Middle Earth.
Yeah, it's not something I thought a ton about before, but I could see that definitely also because you see these pieces here and there of Gollum kind of remembering his past life among mm-hmm. the river folk, basically, with things he'll say like, well, we used to have these stories, which are very similar to Hobbit yeah. stories. And we also saw back with Bilbo and his enjoyment of riddles. So I guess I think there's a part of him that still remembers that life. And I think mm-hmm. oaths would kind of be in the same neighborhood as riddles in a way that he would be familiar with yeah. them and understand and appreciate their power, I think.
That's true. All right, let's jump ahead to cards now. So we kind of already mentioned Fast Hitch. Mm-hmm. But that of course came directly from this chapter, and I don't know. Should we go ahead and talk about our listener submitted card? Should we go ahead and jump down to that since it's pertinent to this chapter?
Sure,
sure.
Let's do it. So, Philip B gave us a really cool card called Elven Rope. It is a one cost spirit attachment. It is an item. And it says, attached to a hobbit or scout hero, limit one per hero. Quest response. Exhaust elven rope to lower the threat of a location that was just added to the staging area by one until the end of the phase. At the end of the travel phase, place one progress on that location if it is the active location.
Mm.
What do you guys think about this? Mm. My first thought is it should probably be unique, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's very thematic.
Yeah,
yeah. I feel like it's pretty well balanced overall. Sometimes custom cards can get a little crazy with the power level, but seems fairly reasonable to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I dig it.
Yeah. I'm going to print that one out. So good job, Philip B. But Fast Hitch, I just wanted to read the quote on Fast Hitch, kind of what we're talking about. It says, and I put as fast a hitch over the stump as anyone could have done, and the Shire out of it. That's the quote from Sam from this chapter. So, of course, we all love Fast Hitch because it's just free, you know, free, but cheap readying. Let's see. Well, the other major card that we have to talk about is from the Journey to the Crossroads quest, which... Oh, I'm sorry, not the Journey to the Cross, but the Passage of the Marsage quest. The first stage of that quest is the Taming of Smeagol, and this is where we get the thematic grand slam of the Gollum / Smeagol flippable objective card.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that for a little bit.
One of the greatest designs in all the history of design of this game.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
If I'm remembering correctly, that's the stage also where when you attack Gollum, you have to like flip an encounter card and then he gets extra defense. So to me, that kind of represents how he's extra slippery, like where Sam thinks he gets the jump on him and then Gollum's like on top of him in the next moment. So it's hard to pin down Gollum.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it talks about just how unexpectedly strong he
is.
I was just kind of going back through that quest today and I felt the same way when I read that condition on the quest card that he adds. You flip a card and you add the threat to, I believe, both his attack and defense. But that's a great way to kind of emulate the unexpected strength that he has, especially when he's just a 2-2-2-5, mm-hmm. you know. So, but then finally, when you beat him into submission, you flip him over, and he becomes old Smeagol.
Yep.
The theme is so perfect because there are treachery effects that can flip him, or like where you choose, like, oh, either do this or flip him. And I really like that because it plays into this thought of, you know, you can't really ever trust him when he's single. At any moment, something could happen and he could flip back to Gollum.
Yeah. Yeah, after you quest unsuccessfully, he flips back to being an enemy.
And then he also, there's a few locations in that quest.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that quest or the Shelob quest? Maybe both, actually, that part of the travel cost is exhausting Smeagol. So, of course, that plays into his role as the guide.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's so well done there.
So good.
Yeah, played it actually Thursday at our local group, which was timely.
Oh, cool.
And it's just one of the saga ones. It's fun to just drop right into it and play it, and it's thematic, and it's challenging but in an interesting way.
Yeah.
It really, that's the difference, though. It's funny, we think, like, I think of why I don't like Hills of Imman Wheel, and I do like Passage of the Marshes so much, and locations play pretty prominently in both of them, but there's the strategy around, you know, getting Gollum to Sméagol, and then what, you know, the decisions you make as far as travel and all that stuff is a lot more interesting and dynamic than, whereas Imman Wheel, I feel like, is just like, yeah, you just plow through as many locations as quickly as possible.
Yeah, not a lot of nuance.
Not particularly. Mm-mm.
Well, we could talk about Sméagol all day, but we must forge ahead. Shall we pass these marshes?
Yep, let's do it.
Passage these marshes. All right, so the next chapter in Book 4 is, of course, the Passage of the Marshes. And after a day or so of pleasantness, a renewed Sméagol leads the Hobbit safely through the Emyn Muil and into the marshes. The going is slow. They see the lights and are sternly warned by Gollum not to look at them. Sam sees dead faces there in the marshes. A winged Nazgul swoops overhead, and after about 5 days, they emerge from the marshes into the no man's land before Mordor, where Gollum has a chat with himself.
This is probably my favorite of the three, and actually, it's a chapter I've always really remembered and held close to my heart, just because even though not much happens in terms of action, there... that setting is just so evocative, and I feel like it's been hugely influential on fantasy. Like, the idea of a treacherous marsh location has, like, popped up in almost every fantasy novel since, I feel like.
Yeah. It's a kind of like the upgraded version of the Midgewater Marsh, which we got all the way back in, you know, Book 1. But instead of midges, you got ghosts or whatever, which I think the mar, you know, and I kind of mentioned this a little bit with the Emyn Muil, but the marshes themselves are a character in this particular chapter, because Sméagol kind of tells us how they keep expanding and they keep disturbing the graves of this huge battle plane that happened an age ago. It's very mysterious too, which again I find them, as I get older, I'm becoming more comfortable with mystery in general, but the Lord of the Rings is kind of a soft target for that ease of mystery. But, you know, Sméagol says, like, when they talk about the lights, nobody knows. Sméagol doesn't know.
Yeah.
But it's kind of the same thing with the marshes. I'm sad to say, even though I have taught social studies, I don't know enough about geography to know how rapidly swamps and marshes expand. But this marsh has been expanding for, you know, centuries now, and it's kind of swallowing up these graves. And yet, as Sam notes, maybe it's Frodo, the bodies are eerily preserved, you know, and there's these lights that Gollum tells them not to look into. And while nobody falls into the water like they do in the films, there's still this kind of dead magical air about it. So I don't know. I think that's one thing I appreciated about the chapter, was the mysteriousness of the marshes themselves.
Yeah. I think you're right about how that the land itself is a character, because in the Aragorn half of the Two Towers, we're really seeing actual antagonist characters that our heroes are facing off against, and here it's basically the different environments is their antagonist in this portion of the book. But I feel like it's one of those things I've heard people joke about, whether either joking or seriously critiquing, saying, well, isn't it convenient that there's all these treacherous locations around Sauron's stronghold? There's the Dead Marshes, there's Emyn Muil. He has this whole mountain range that's wrapping around Mordor. I even saw there was a whole article about why the geography is impossible to have this mountain range like wrapping around. But to me, I feel like that all that is kind of fun to look into, but it misses the point completely, which is that, I mean, of course all this stuff is around it, because this is representing Sauron's influence. Even more than that, even more than just Sauron's influence, I feel like this goes all the way back to, like, First Age Morgoth stuff, which is that when the Valar were trying to shape the Earth, Morgoth kept constantly screwing it up and corrupting it. So I feel like this harkens all the way back to that, with this idea that there are parts of the land that still have this Morgoth influence in it from way back then. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of Dead Marshes, it is directly related to Sauron, with, you know, kind of the aftermath of that battle. But, I mean, I guess my point is that a lot of Sauron's power is elemental.
Yeah.
And almost like a twisted version of Tom Bombadil in a way, in that these environments that are around him, he's also part of and shaping in some way.
Yeah, it's fear, it's subversion of the will of others, and it's elemental, like you're saying. I mean, because even with the Southrons and the Haradrim, he's really just telling them, like, he's whispering to them all the things, the innate hatred that they would have of Gondor, just like Saruman does the same thing with the Dunlendings and Rohan, and then he's using their fear of him to basically manipulate them into fighting Gondor for him, you know. So it's all of that stuff is about, and yeah, it echoes from the first age where Morgoth was a god of manipulation, and he only knew how to mar the things that the other Valar had made. He didn't make things himself. But in the case of the Dead Marshes, that it's so funny to be like, oh, why is all this crazy stuff around him? Well, because people keep sending armies to try and kill him. Like, you have all these undead. What do the undead represent? Well, in the fall of Gil-galad, when Elendil, cuts the ring off, there's all these dead men and elves that were trying, they went there with the last alliance of elves and men to destroy Sauron. That's why you have all these undead around your HQ, is everyone keeps coming to try and kill you.
But it keeps coming and getting killed.
Yeah. I also find this idea of a huge cataclysmic battle like that actually causing a change in the land very interesting, especially as, mm-hmm. I know Tolkien, of course, didn't want people to draw direct parallels, but having fought in World War I with which featured some huge grisly battles and battlefields afterwards, with just corpses strewn everywhere. I can't help but feel like that has an influence here with this idea of like a battle can be so terrible that it changes the land forever afterwards.
Definitely. And I'm going to jump ahead a little bit before we because this is a good segue to a part that I had to highlight as we're talking about the land, at the tail end of the chapter, or just before the end, before Sméagol has his little conversation with himself, they get out of the marshes and they reach the space between the marshes and Mordor itself. And man, the description is just so good. I think, Dan, you said at the beginning that after we get out of the Emin Muil, we get some more floral descriptions. And I'm just going to read a little bit just because I love it so much. But this is, again, this is just as they exit the marshes and they get to that space before Mordor. It says, out from their feet were flung huge buttresses and broken hills that were now at the nearest scarce a dozen miles away. Frodo looked round in horror. Dreadful as the Dead Marshes had been, and the arid moors of the No Man's Land, more loathsome far was the country that the crawling day now slowly unveiled to his shrinking eyes. I'll skip ahead a little bit. Here nothing lived, not even the leprous growths that feed on rottenness. The gasping pools were choked with ash and crawling muds, sickly white and gray, as if the mountains had vomited the filth of their entrails upon the lands about. So even though we've got that image in our mind of this exact scene from the films, it's like the films aren't even close to how disgusting and nasty and just depraved the land is here, and it's all because of what Sauron has done. It's crazy.
Yeah, that stood out to me as well, and especially the fact that he compares it unfavorably to the Dead Marshes, that this is worse. Because I feel like the Dead Marshes are pretty horrific. Like, I wouldn't want to take a night hike through there. And it is pretty scary just being completely in the dark other than these lights. But at least, I don't know, there's still a magic to it, and almost like a nobility to it, that in a way these dead are still commemorated, is not the right word. I don't know exactly how to express what I'm trying to say, but there's
some sign of life and activity.
Yeah, there's something like almost that something about their memory has been preserved, even though it's kind of scary and ghastly. But the No Man's Land is just like the destruction of magic, the destruction of life, just complete void, because of Sauron's like, and kind of a critique of like industrial activity too, I think. But all of that.
I mean, some of those battlefields, in France and Germany from World War I, for generations, you would go back and you could still see that there was just desolation. So it's not, again, he doesn't like allegory, but I'm going to go there. It's you can see the parallels. War does that. You know, the land does not immediately recover. Yavanna is not that powerful that immediately after a battle, everything just goes back to looking idyllic.
Yeah.
There's one other thing, and this is going back a little bit because we jumped forward, that I wanted to talk about as far as the narrative is. It's on like the second page of the chapter. Sam starts like thinking about the question of food, of like, how are we going to have enough food to actually do this journey? Because he realizes like how far they have to go. And it's really important. The answer ultimately that Frodo gives to that is to that question comes a couple pages later, and I just wanted to read it very quickly because it gives you a glimpse into the mindset that Frodo has on this quest, a very fatalistic glimpse, I should say. Is that Frodo, in response to Sam's question of how are we, you know, what are we going to do about the food, says, "If the one goes into the fire and we are at hand, I ask you, Sam, are we ever likely to need bread again?" I think not. So it's very, like, he knows that he is tasked as the ring bearer, and he knows that they have a long way to go, and it's going to be dangerous, and they he's trying to, like, that's why they enlist Gollum, is he's trying to find a way, how do I even get in to Mordor? It's not an easy task just getting there, much less destroying it once you're there, especially undiscovered, because they constantly are having Nazgul fly overhead and whatnot. And for him to just recognize, hey, like, our goal at this point is just to get there, because I don't assume we're going to make it out alive.
Definitely.
Yeah, that definitely stood out to me as well. I guess that's another sign of kind of Frodo's quality as a character, that he has his eyes wide open of what's ahead. Kind of the last thing from this chapter that stood out to me, in addition to that, was the eye of Sauron, which in yes. the movies is actually a big burning eye. Yes. But in the book, it's kind of a more subtle psychological thing. And the line that stood out to me that I didn't pay much attention to before was just that Frodo compared it to, like, when you close your eyes and you can still feel the hot sun on you, that's how it feels as they're heading forward. Like, that it's just this, like, presence, this overwhelming will of Sauron looking for the ring, and he just feels it more and more as he goes forward.
Yeah. Yeah, and he describes it more of like a sense or a presence, yeah, rather than, you know.
I totally think of it like a gravity well, where as you approach a black hole, everything just is like bending towards that.
Yeah.
Even if it's not fully pulled into it, it's everything just all light bends towards Sauron anywhere within a certain radius of the Dark Tower.
And we see a little bit of this. In addition to that stuff, we see a few more lines that I think Peter Jackson and company kind of ran with, which is where Gollum, the Nazgul swoop over them several times, and Gollum talks about how the Nazgul feel the ring coming closer, you know, how they can sense it. So, I don't, as usual, the book is more nuanced than the films, but you kind of see where they got their ideas from, whereas there is a sense to it. It's not as vivid as it's depicted in other forms, but in the there is definitely a pull physically on Frodo, but also from the Nazgul and the other baddies as well, as the ring kind of gets closer to Mordor. And I guess the last thing we need to talk about before we get to cards is that very thing. The Nazgul and the various and the proximity to Mordor and several other factors start to do something to Gollum. So just a week ago, he was happy old Smeagol. We begin to see this the conflict between Gollum and Smeagol, Slinker and Stinker, and we get the first mention of she. She might help. She might, yes.
Who is she?
Sam doesn't know, but I like that foreshadowing. It's I don't know. It's cool. It's very ominous.
Yeah. It also makes me think back to the previous chapters that we thought were about totally unrelated stuff, and it's a nice way to kind of actually connect them, is that if not for the good guys winning, you know, the Battle of the Hornburg, Frodo and Sam are probably screwed at this point, because the Nazgul would be able to, his eye, quote-unquote, would be elsewhere. But because of what's going on over in, you know, near Isengard and then in the Hornburg, it's obvious at a certain point that that's drawing his attention away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. His power, even though he's very powerful, it's still finite. He's not omniscient.
Yeah, it's interesting, I guess. I like the way Sam frame. I think it's Sam who frames it this way, that the two sides of Gollum have kind of come to a compromise with each other. That they both want similar things, even though one is, quote, evil and the other is good. But they kind of are come to a little bit of a peace between each other, I guess.
Right.
I think there's a lot to talk about like the nature of what Tolkien is trying to say with Gollum and the role of selfishness and all that. But I don't know. I feel like that's a whole other can of worms to open.
We could talk about it a little bit more in the next chapter. Cause I'm with you. Like, to me as a narrative, there honestly isn't a whole lot that went on in these chapters. You go Imin Muil, Dead Marshes, you go to the gate. Oh crap. We can't go this way. Like narrative. That's, we could talk about that for 5 minutes, but the stuff with Gollum and the dynamic between Frodo and Gollum to me is way more interesting than what happened in terms of where they went on the map.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's look at some cards real quick. The first card I want to point out, and then we'll see what cards you guys want to talk about, is the Searching Eye. This is one of the burden cards that you get from campaign mode, which is basically a player card. But when you draw it, you either exhaust each hero you control or you reveal an encounter card. So the imagery is great. It's the three of them diving, you know, to hide from the Nazgul as he flies overhead. But I like that. I feel that's very thematic in that when you, it's Frodo, you know, and the rest of them have that sense of the eye or the Nazgul searching for them, you got to do something about it. You either, you know, either have to exhaust, which is representative of kind of hiding or making some kind of, taking some kind of action to get away from it, or something bad's coming, in this case, an encounter card. So I thought that was a great adaptation, from the text of this chapter. What are some of the cards you guys like?
I love Candlebearer. There's just something about, and the way he describes it in that particular passage, you know, there's these dead, you know, these spirits that are ill at rest. They died under probably horrible circumstances, and they're not willing to leave Middle Earth because of it. And just this idea that there's this kind of candle glowing there and the shadows it would cast, and everything's very poetic and descriptive. And I don't know, that always stuck with me, even from back when I was, you know, the first time this book was ever read to me, I've always remembered that part of the passage.
Yeah.
This, not so much a particular card, but the enemies in general, I always had respect for the challenge of trying to adapt this chapter to a quest where there are no enemies, like, because it's not even clear that there are real corpses under there. It's more like they're images that have been preserved there. But obviously you can't turn that into a quest because that wouldn't be that interesting. So I do like the choice to turn the undead into actual enemies. My one thing is I kind of wish they had adapted the, I can't even remember if there was a name for the mechanic or not, but the mechanic in Stone of Eric, where you attacked with willpower. I thought that would have been a good fit here, especially because hobbits are better equipped in that area than, attack, but
the focus here is more on the landscape, right? With the mire keyword.
Yeah, probably they didn't want to have like two different mechanics going on, so they went with Meyer.
Yeah. Long Meyer.
Yeah, it is difficult when the book is more trying to get it to be psychological, the fear, and then in the game you have to have physical, concrete, spectral. I'm with you on that. Spectral would have been really cool to bring back, but I guess they probably feel like they want to do unique things for each of the saga stuff.
Right. Yeah.
Shall we go to the Black Gate?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah,
I hear it's closed this time of day. Thank you, Ian.
I got you.
Okay. So the third chapter of book four is The Black Gate is Closed, which picks up just where we left off. The Hobbits and Gollum deliberate before the Black Gate, deciding what to do. And just as Frodo is set to leave and pass into certain doom, Gollum mentions another way, and he explains the journey past Minas Morgul and through the pass in the mountains, Cirith Ungol. And just as they are discussing and deliberating, an army begins to enter Mordor through the Black Gate. Herodrim pass, and Sam inquires about Olyphant, gives us a bit of poetry. And finally, Frodo decides to trust Gollum once more, and they set off for his secret way.
And her secret way, too.
Her secret way. And this is just what you were saying, Dan. Like, literally no movement happens. They're just sitting in the same hole this entire chapter, but so much interplay happens between the characters. Yeah. And we learn so much about Gollum.
Yeah, I guess this is the place to have that conversation, but it's just interesting. Obviously, the through line of these three chapters and the whole rest of the Frodo-Sam story is kind of obvious that they would have been toast without Gollum, that the pieces needed to fall into place to have Gollum there. I mean, you even think about a hypothetical scenario where Gandalf was with them and they probably wouldn't have had Gollum with them, and then what would have happened? So, I guess it's not so much like, what is Tolkien trying to imply? Because that's pretty clear, but what does that mean? Like, what does that mean that this selfish, I mean, you could call him evil creature, is kind of key to victory.
Yeah, that's the quote, right? It is my fate, Frodo says, it is my fate to receive help from you. So it's like, what is all that about?
Yeah, fate comes up a lot in these chapters, and Frodo's sense of, you know, kind of duty, but also kind of fatalism of like, well, if this is how it has to go. But yeah, it is fascinating to me as a tragic arc, the whole Gollum character. Is like, I don't see him as evil, but I could absolutely see someone arguing that he is, and to me he's more just really, you know, kind of tragic, and he represents the like, he's a physical manifestation of the corrupting influence of the ring over time, I think.
Yeah.
But to me, he's like sympathetic in a way, really.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's, you know, if any character deserves kind of the thumbs up, from in terms of character development, it's Smeagol, because you hate him one minute and you love him the next.
Yeah,
I wonder if there's something there about evil always bringing about its own demise. Through the way it does things, because you're right, yeah, that he is a physical manifestation of corruption. Like, the ring created Gollum, essentially. Like, he used to be Smeagol, but the ring transformed him into some other being, basically. And that being, through Gollum's own lust for the ring, ends up being the thing that destroys it. Spoiler alert. So again, it's kind of this mechanic we see a lot in Tolkien, where the things that evil does end up bringing about its own end.
Yeah.
Yeah, and getting back to our earlier discussion of oaths, that's really important in terms of him having Gollum swear on the ring and even warning Gollum before they do that, that there's this sense of, like, predestiny of, like, you swearing. And there's multiple times in these chapters where Frodo tells him, you are never going to get the ring. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how exactly that plays out, right? Like, Gollum, the whole reason that Gollum, both sides in the end of the last chapter, made a truce is they both definitely don't want Sauron to get it and would rather be there to watch what Frodo does with it than not. Mm-hmm, so yeah, they're both kind of in agreement, like, hey, let's keep an eye on Frodo. Let's make sure that Sauron never gets the ring, because everyone agrees that's a bad idea. Yeah. And then kind of see... Huh?
He'll eat us all.
Yeah,
it's such a great line. He'll eat us all. It's a very, like, it's funny how Gollum thinks of everything as a metaphor for eating fish.
Yeah.
So that, like even when he talks about Gollum the Great, it would be like, I'll give fish to you hobbits if I get the ring back. Like, everyone will get fish. You know, that's his, like, currency of power is fish.
But I want to talk about that some more. This kind of weird, and again, I don't have it all laid out, but this kind of weird interplay and overlap between Gollum, Frodo, and Sauron. What particularly brings that to mind is the line where Gollum says he only has four fingers on the black hand, but they are enough. Mm. So number one, I get so annoyed with that part in the movie where Gandalf says he cannot yet take physical form. Well, he's got fingers. So how is he gonna put the ring on without fingers?
Ghost gloves, Derek. Ghost gloves.
Ghost gloves. The invisible man. He's gonna wrap himself in toilet paper. But the so he's obviously corporeal, but also this whole idea that he is permanently marred in the finger that he lost to Isildur, even though he's a spiritual being, and then the fact that Frodo, spoiler alert, loses a finger later on, becomes Frodo of the Nine Fingers. Like, to me, that had never hit me before, but that's just such a creepy, cool parallel between the two of them, that the Dark Lord has not had nine fingers, and Frodo, the Ring Bearer, had nine fingers. That just stood out to me.
It is one of the overarching Tolkien themes, I think, though, is that you don't go through the experience of interacting with power on that level and not have it change you fundamentally, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely can't just casually carry the ring in and slam dunk it into the fire.
Can't just drop it from an eagle's back.
I feel like it's one of those eternal dynamics that you'll probably have to spend a lifetime figuring out because there are no clear answers. But I guess it does all go back to what Gandalf was saying, that it's not up to you, lowly mortal, to decide the fate of someone else and say, oh, they're beyond hope, or they're beyond anything. Any reason to keep alive, and that you should end their story because you never know where their story will lead. That it all comes down to that in the end, I guess.
Right.
That people are pursuing wicked ends can sometimes still bring about a better fate unwittingly.
True.
It's interesting how much depth there is to the what's going on between the characters, given how very little is happening on the surface of any of these three, really. I mean, there was, there's moments where, they could have fallen off a cliff, but they didn't. They could have fallen into the water, but they didn't. They could have gone the wrong way and got caught by Nazgul, but they didn't. They could have been spotted by Nazgul flying overhead, but they didn't. They end up at a gate. They decide not to go in, obviously, and they end up being okay and going the other way. But yet, all the things that are happening, behind the scenes is the interesting stuff here.
Yeah.
To kind of tie up a couple of the threads that we were mentioning before, like, again, this is a clear leadership moment for Frodo, where he is the one who has to make the decision to take Gollum's secret path or not. And this is the moment of his awesome metal threat to force Gollum to jump into the fire. And then the other piece is, now I lost my train of thought. I guess that was the main thing, but I also was interested about, because they're talking about this other path through Cirith Ungol, and Tolkien does this interesting thing where he shifts away from Frodo's internal thoughts and goes to say what other people would think, and says that Gandalf would warn him against it, and that Aragorn would tell him of that name and its significance. So it's interesting that he does that, but I also was like, what is the name and its significance? So looking up Cirith Ungol means spider's cleft in Sindarin. So I guess that would be useful to know. It's a bit of a hint.
Spoilers. Yeah. It's the thing that I love is I love looking back and saying, how would they have actually destroyed the ring if not? I mean, I understand that they almost die, but like, this is really the only way they're getting into Mordor.
Yeah, that was tormenting too. Yeah. What was Gandalf's plan exactly? What would Gandalf have done in that to get into Mordor?
He would have rode a bunch of Ollifons
straight through the front door. Maybe he knew of secret path that other people don't. I don't know. I can't see him going through the Black Gate, and obviously he didn't want to go past Shelob or through Minas Morgul. I don't know.
And Gollum even talks about what it would take to actually go around those mountains, like, because he said that he had been way out east, and that's just way too long of a journey. They're starved to death before they
get
around. Yeah.
I don't know. I doubt Tolkien ever even knew, but Gandalf would have thought of something, I'm sure. I think he probably was planning to maybe talk to Galadriel about it when he got there, maybe.
Right, especially because Aragorn's plan was originally to go to Minas Tirith, so I don't know, maybe there would have been, I don't know, there would have been something, but it would make for some good fan fiction.
So many what ifs. Mm-hmm. So many what ifs.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about cards here. So this particular moment isn't explicitly touched on, but in the Journey to the Crossroads quest, the Black Gate comes up, because this is, you guys help me out with this, but the Black Gate quest kind of the Journey to the Crossroads quest kind of overlaps this moment where the Herodrim are coming into Mordor, and then the yep. point where they meet up with Faramir, and Faramir ambushes the Southrons as well. So really the Black Gate itself, which has some beautiful art, is I don't know, the only touch point I could kind of find with this particular chapter. And the whole deal is that, you know, at the beginning of the chapter, the Black Gate and the Teeth, the Towers of the Teeth, are described, and there's that lovely line where they say, another dreadful day of fear and toil had come to Mordor. Yeah. And the Herodrim, our armies, are passing into the gate, and of course the whole point of that quest is to kill off as many of them as you can before they get into Mordor. But I don't know, that was the only parallel I could find. Do you guys have any other ones that are worth talking about?
Man, you weren't kidding about the art. I'm looking at this card right now, and it makes me wish the cards in this game were twice the size, because yeah. that art is fantastic.
That'd be an awesome playmat yeah. or something. yeah. I can't really think of a ton of cards, because they are just basically sitting in a pit talking and thinking. it is interesting that they mentioned that those two watchtowers were actually built by Gondor and kind of were meant to watch yeah. Sauron, but another case of Sauron perverting stuff that's not
such his. A Sauron move to take a beautiful thing that someone else made and be classic, like, wow, I'll show you how I'm
this needs more
this.
Spikes.
Wait, definitely more spikes.
200%
make
more
it
spikes
more metal.
He just shows them a metal album cover. Make it look more like this.
metal eye for the album.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, there it is.
The
I don't think we could get much better than that.
Oh, man. Perfect. There you go. I'm going to pitch that to Netflix. All right,
dude,
let's
at this point, they'll probably give it to you, man. They're just trying to crank out that original
trying to get
content.
Rid of money.
No one, I guarantee you, no one's ever pitched that shit before. We really like Lorien. We were just wondering, could the flowers be black?
They're just going in and painting black eyeliner on Galadriel. More!
Then it looks like her thin's just Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah.
I don't know. She'd probably still be the most beautiful being in Middle-earth, even with yeah. black eyeliner. But
yeah. She's going through a goth phase. Well, we're going to end things here with a listener question that we've been sitting on for a while. Benedict K. sent us this question, and I couldn't quite find a way to shoehorn it into our book discussion, so we're just going to go for it
sure.
so that we can attempt to answer Benedict's question. And his email said, in the card game, there are cards which give faction traits to allies and heroes, like Elfrend, Sword of Morthond, or Nor Am I a Stranger. Nor Am I a Stranger references Aragorn's past and Rohan. What do you guys think about the future race trait giving attachments? Will we see something like a Hobbit trait giving card? Why or why not? I've had this thought because I don't play it anymore, or I barely play it anymore, but I used to play a lot of the Lord of the Rings online game, and a title you can earn in that game if you do a bunch of quests in the Shire is the title Honorary Sheriff. And so that was the Hobbit trait giving attachment, which I assumed would come with the Scouring of the Shire, but alas, it did not make the cut for that box. But I don't think this will actually make it into the game, especially now that we know the next cycle is going into Rovanion. But that's my fan card, as the Honorary Sheriff attached character gets the Hobbit trait. But I guess more realistically, can you guys think of any other traits that might be trait-giving attachments we might see?
I just realized it would have been amazing if Caleb had done an appendix saga box of, like, one more of, like, yeah, this is all the stuff that didn't fit in the others. That would have been so awesome.
I would have loved that. To answer the question, I don't think we'll see one for hobbits or dwarves ever, mainly because... in the case of dwarves, because they're just bonkers, and so if you give someone
it would have to cost like
giving someone the dwarf trait is like incredibly powerful. In the case of hobbits, they tend to get like these cheap, powerful attachments, and the reason why is because they're exclusive to hobbits. So I don't see. So there's definitely theme reasons you could do both, but I think just more mechanically, we probably won't see either.
Yeah.
And I think Elfren kind of had to exist just because it features so prominently in the narrative, and it does make sense. But yeah, I'm completely with Ian on this. From a game mechanic standpoint, if you had an attachment that permanently gave the dwarf trait, it would have to cost a minimum of like 3, because otherwise the broken things you could do with that are just kind of absurd.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe with Dale, we'll see some friend of Dale, or I don't know, some kind of thing that gives you the Dale trait.
Bard's bodyguard.
Yeah. Bard's quiver holder.
Cool. All right, that was a great question, and that leads us perfectly into the ending. This has been episode 58 of the Great Company Podcast, and of course, if you want to get in touch with us and send us interesting questions like this one, head to our website at greatcompanypodcast.com, and from there you can connect with us via email, Twitch, Facebook, Twitter, and so on. As always, this episode has been brought to you by our patrons, and if you would like to help us with hosting fees and so on, please head to patreon.com/grayco to sign up. Thanks to Philip B., the latest to join our Hobbitry in Arms. Thanks to all of you for listening, and until next time, farewell. Tonight we'll explore the taming of Smeagol, the passage of the Marshage. Oh my god, why did I have whiskey?